Welcome to The Forum, a world of ideas from the BBC. Hello, I'm Bridget Kendall. What are the qualities that help you to be top of the class, or outsmart your competitors, or win a game against the odds? This week we investigate advantage, what we're born with, and what depends on our environment, why being the underdog, far from being an obstacle, could actually help you, and whether it's not our own advantage we should worry about, but that of future generations. With me in the Forum studio today are journalist and best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell, former World Bank Vice President and Professor of Globalisation Ian Goldin, and psychologist and collaborator on research into behavioural genetics, Dr. Catherine Asprey. Welcome to all of you, and can I start by just asking you each briefly, just in one sentence, what you would say is the best advantage you've had in your life, either something you were born with or something you acquired along the way? Malcolm Gladwell.
Well, I was born in England, into a civilized, first world, safe, prosperous country. There can be no bigger advantage than that.
A very diplomatic answer here in London. What about you, Catherine Asprey?
I would say my best advantage was my mum. I was born to a disadvantaged 18-year-old girl who, with astonishing maturity, decided that education was the way that I could have a better life than her.
Interesting. Ian Goldin.
I think my biggest advantage is a loving family. I was born in Pretoria, which I would consider a disadvantage
in
for
South
most
Africa.
At that time under apartheid, but managed to understand that one could have freedom in one's lifetime, and that was a very important early beginning.
It's so interesting, Catherine and Ian, that you both talk about advantage also as disadvantage, because Malcolm Gladwell, you're a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, but you've also got a string of best-selling books to your name, and at the heart of your latest book, David and Goliath, is absolutely this idea that we often underestimate the advantage of being disadvantaged. Can you explain a bit more, why is it so good to be the underdog?
Well, not always. One of the key concepts in the book is a notion of desirable difficulty, which is a term that a team of psychologists at UCLA called the Bjorks, who have expanded on this. But the notion is that we can divide difficulties into two groups. Those that are undesirable, that are clear obstacles and setbacks that leave us worse off than we would have been otherwise. But there are also a set of difficulties that can prove ultimately advantageous, that, in other words, force us to learn certain kinds of things, develop certain kinds of skills, pursue certain kinds of strategies that we would not have done otherwise. And I think the trick is to figure out what difficulty belongs in what category.
So give us some examples of difficulties which are desirable.
Well, I have a chapter on dyslexia, which points out that a small, I underline small, number of dyslexics will tell you that they believe their dyslexia accounted for their life success. So we know from studies of entrepreneurs, that successful entrepreneurs, that a hugely disproportionate number of them have been diagnosed with some kind of learning disorder, particularly dyslexia.
Dyslexia is basically finding it hard to learn to read.
I remember talking to one of the best trial lawyers in America is a dyslexic, who said that what he learned from his dyslexia was how to listen, and he developed his memory. And for a trial lawyer, having an extraordinary memory and really knowing how to listen is advantageous ultimately. And his argument was to me, I would never have mastered those two particular gifts if I had had the conventional set of intellectual abilities. Now, he's someone who has a very, very high IQ and came from a very strong family. So he had no other prominent difficulties, but he had one specific difficulty that turned out to be desirable in the end.
I suppose if you're going to generalize about this, though, you have to be careful not to mix up cause and correlation, don't you? I mean, this trial lawyer, you have to ask, would he have made a great trial lawyer even if he hadn't been?
Well, we see,
had learning difficulties with reading.
This is by no means a kind of settled conclusion. It's an observation, a suggestive observation, particularly with entrepreneurs, it's most striking. Some estimates put the number of successful entrepreneurs with dyslexia as high as 30%. That could be a coincidence. It could mean nothing. But it's powerfully suggestive of something.
Yeah, I mean, entrepreneurs, you have to be very persistent. Maybe you need to have very good people skills. Mm-hmm. Maybe having your nose in a book doesn't develop those skills quite as well. You can sort of see why there might be a reason why they develop skills which are useful to become a very successful businessman.
Yeah.
You give other examples. I mean, one I know that you cited is, isn't it interesting that the high number of US presidents, 12 out of 44, who lost a parent when they were young.
And also the high number of English prime ministers, the same.
And English prime ministers, yeah. Right. Is this the question of learning to cope with something which felt like a setback or a trauma when you were young, actually gives you the ability to overcome obstacles when you get bigger?
Yeah, again, it's the same observation as dyslexia. For most people, suffering the death of a parent at a very young age is clearly an undesirable difficulty. But there seem to be a very small number of people who, in conquering or overcoming that particular disadvantage, find themselves better equipped to deal with highly competitive, highly stressful environments. And so the great question is, what differentiates those for whom the loss of a parent ends up being ultimately advantageous from those for whom it is a undesirable difficulty? And that's a fascinating, complicated question. I don't presume to answer it in my book, but it's the kind of conversation I'd love to start over this question of advantage.
Let's try it out on my other guest, because Catherine Asprey, you're a psychologist.
Yes.
What do you think about what Malcolm's been saying? Do you think there's something here that's worth investigating?
I think with any suggestion, there's always something worth investigating. I feel slightly uncomfortable with the idea of portraying dyslexia and the death of a parent as a desirable difficulty. I feel much more comfortable with the idea of talking about people who succeed in spite of their difficulties rather than because of their difficulties. Mm-hmm. And that's because it rings more true for me. But also, I do worry about putting out the idea that something like dyslexia is a desirable difficulty, because I think it could potentially make life harder for some children and families. And I think partly this is a problem because you're so successful, because you write so well, because people want to read your books, and they're people who are not going to read academic journal articles. Mm-hmm. So they go away, and in some cases, they think they've read the science, and I think that isn't always the case. They've read some of it and one interpretation of it. But I think when the idea goes out that all dyslexic children are going to be successful entrepreneurs, I know that's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's clearly not what you say. And as you point out, that prisons are full of people with dyslexia and who've lost parents as well. It can be very damaging. But I think framing it as a desirable difficulty is potentially problematic.
I mean, this is an interesting question of whether, as a writer, you have to worry about the potential for misinterpretation of your work. I don't believe you should censor yourself because of a fear that someone is going to read your work incorrectly. That's a very dangerous path to go down. And these are profoundly interesting questions, because what if, in looking at that small number of dyslexics who have managed to achieve disproportionately, if we believe their argument, what if we learn something very valuable that allows us to help the larger group for whom that's not a desirable difficulty? In other words, this is an enormously useful, potentially useful line of inquiry. And I think it's always dangerous to silence yourself out of a fear of a kind of a bastardization of your thesis down the road.
Ian Golden.
Yeah, I found the argument fascinating, and it touched a very sensitive note with me personally, because my father died when I was 5 and I have a son who's dyslexic, and so it got me thinking to what extent these might have been the reason why I've done what I have in my life, or my son is doing what he's doing. And I think there's definitely something in it, but I feel much more strongly that we're not pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that are sort of carved in some way and then fit into our surrounds, but rather that it's a constantly shaping and evolving thing. And if I had been born, for example, as it were, on the other side of the tracks, if I'd been born a black South African, and my father died at the age of 5, the outcome would have been fundamentally different. To what it was for me. And similarly, my son, if we hadn't been able to give him the schooling that he's had and other things, his life would be fundamentally different for him. So these things are significant, but I think the environment and how one engages with the environment, and that's got to do with fortune, but many other things as well, perhaps are even more significant.
Mm-hmm.
Another point that you make in your book, which is about environment, is about educational advantage. And you suggest that sometimes trying to get to the top universities like Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard might not be the best strategy, because actually you might be better off if you're a big fish in a small pond at a less prestigious institution. Can you explain your thinking there?
Yeah, this is a an observation that's been made from a number of different perspectives. There's a psychologist at Oxford, Herbert Marsh, who has written extensively on this idea of big fish, little pond, or little fish, big pond, which is a preferable environment for the development of academic confidence. And he has a lot of data to suggest that in elite environments, you have this very fascinating phenomenon that the bottom third of the class at, you know, in a competitive math class at Oxford or MIT or Harvard can feel as badly about their math ability as someone who's in the bottom third of a much less elite school. Why? Because they're not thinking of themselves in the grand context of the world, where they're clearly in the 99.9th percentile. They're thinking of themselves in the context of their classroom. That's all part of a larger argument, which I'm arguing on the other side of the equation, that there are certain kinds of advantages that we overrate. And I believe that prestige and selectivity in educational institutions is an overrated characteristic. We have assigned far more value to it than is appropriate.
I'm immediately thinking, well, number one, if you go to an elite institution, mm-hmm. there are perhaps networks and contacts which might be useful later on. That's mm-hmm. a practical argument. But on an educational level too, maybe instead of being downhearted by being surrounded by bright kids, you might be inspired by it. You might want to compete and do better yourself, or even learn from your peers.
Yeah, that would have been my intuitive thought as well, that there should be these collateral advantages to selective institutions. Problem is that when we do systematic analysis of this, we can't find those benefits, or those benefits are dwarfed by the undesirable difficulties that come from selectivity.
I guess we ought to say this is some data. I mean, there's all sorts of data, isn't there? You have to look across the piece. I just want to bring Ian Goldin in, because Ian, you teach at Oxford University, definitely seen as an elite educational institution here in the UK. What do you think about this?
Yeah, so I'm a professor at Oxford, and I haven't seen any evidence that people who are in the bottom third either feel that they shouldn't be there, or that they would somehow their life chances or their opportunities would be better if they were at an institution where they would be the top student. Firstly, because employers and the market regards your degree as a place. They don't actually know where you come very often. Secondly, because, as you say, Richard, people do really thrive often. A lot depends on the individual and the mentoring environment. So if you look across the Oxford colleges, for example, the 35 different Oxford colleges, there's some that would do a lot better with kids that were coming in the bottom third than others.
There's also this question of ranking, isn't there, which is what you brought up, Malcolm, that, you know, if you don't get a high grade, then especially in the sciences where things are much more measured, then perhaps you get downhearted. Is that a crucial criteria for this self-measurement of esteem which you're talking about?
We're discussing
about
two different things here. I'm very, very specifically focused as my endpoint on your likelihood of graduating with a science and mathematics degree. So, and the data there are, they're sort of so overwhelming that your chances of graduating successfully fall with any increase in the selectivity of your college. Now, for those who manage to graduate, are they better off in an elite institution? I think the answer is probably yes. But I'm more interested, because dropout rates in the sciences are so high, I use as my point of reference likelihood of graduation.
Let's bring Catherine in here, because Catherine, you teach at the University of York here in the UK, and before that you're at King's College in London, mm-hmm. and you're a psychologist. Some people would say it's a science, some would not. But
yeah,
anyway, what's your viewpoint on this?
So my thoughts go really quickly to schools, because I think in the UK and in other countries as well, there's a national obsession with getting your child to the best school, and the media fuels it furiously. Mm-hmm. I mean, my feeling is very much that you should get your child to the best school for them. You should be looking for the school that's the best fit rather than the school that's the best in a league table. And so I would be really interested to see similar analyses for selective schools and whether children who are maybe tutored and coached very heavily to pass entrance exams and then struggle at the bottom of those schools, how they compare to how they would have compared in the top set of a comprehensive non-selective school. So I think it's fascinating, and there are lots of questions.
We could explore this a lot further, but I want to come on to your own work, your own research, Catherine, which raises other issues, because you're a psychologist who works on educational development and specifically the impact of genetic and environmental influences.
That's right.
In fact, you've just co-written a book with the behavioural geneticist Robert Plomin called G is for Genes, which is all about the impact of genetics on education and achievement. And you're saying that some children do start out with a biological genetic advantage when it comes to maths, for example, or learning to read or write. And you know this through your study of identical twins.
Well, identical and non-identical twins, because the way we establish whether something is heritable, and I'll talk a little bit more about that term in a second, is to look at whether identical twins are more similar than non-identical twins, because the defining difference between the two groups is that the identical twins share all of their genes and the non-identical twins share approximately half. So if identical twins are more similar, then it's likely that genes are involved. And what we actually find is that genes influence the differences between children in how well they do in reading and maths and science and a whole range of academic achievement. They don't determine how well the children do. They don't tell us much at all about how one child will do. It's not like saying that 70% of why I'm good at or bad at maths is my genes and 30% is my environment. They just influence the differences between children in how well they do.
But do we know how much? I mean, we're just talking about dyslexia. How much influence does genetic input have on how easy a child finds it to read or not?
Okay. Reading's actually, I think, the single best way of explaining heritability. So reading, we find, is about 60% heritable.
Wow, but that's very high.
Yeah, but if you think about reading, it makes absolutely no sense to say that reading is genetic. Because if children aren't taught to read and exposed to books and have teachers and parents and resources around them, they'll never learn to read. So in that sense, reading is entirely environmentally driven. Where genes come into play is explaining why some children find it easier to learn to read than others. Some are better readers than others. So if you look at a class of 8-year-olds, you'll find that there might be a couple of children who are still struggling with very simple sentences and needing a lot of support. And there'll be a few children at the other end who are knee-deep in Roald Dahl and long works of fiction and non-fiction. And genes are a major influence on those differences between the children, as are experiences and the interplay between genes and experience.
So are we going to quite soon get to the point where schools will be able to access genetic profiles to help them understand what advantage they might have from their genes as they start school?
The very short answer is no, I would say. We know that genes influence the differences between them in how well they do, and scientists are looking furiously for the genes involved. And what we've learnt so far is that lots and lots of genes are involved. They each have small effects and they interact with each other in very complicated ways. So there may be a time when we have what we call in our book learning chips. We already have them in medicine for genes associated with heart disease and immunological dysfunction. And there may be a time when we have that kind of information for learning abilities and disabilities as well. And that, I think, if and when we get to that stage, could have an influence on how we support children, particularly the most vulnerable children. But we're not there yet. That's not something. If you gave us the DNA sequence for every child in a class right now, apart from anything else, we wouldn't have the foggiest idea what to do with it.
And how do you factor into all this differences in socioeconomic status, how they might affect all of this?
It depends what you mean, really. We do measure socioeconomic status when I work on a twin study. We've been following about 8,000 pairs of twins from birth until now, when the eldest of them are 19. And every couple of years or so, we've tested them in lots of ways, looked at behaviour problems as well. And we've also talked about parenting and school experiences and social status. What we tend to do in our kind of study is correct for those effects and then see if they're making a difference. But we find parents' social status does predict achievement. But one of the things we emphasise very strongly in our book is that where there is disadvantage, whether that's for biological or social reasons, that's where we need to put our resources. That's where we need to provide extra support and create greater equality of opportunity than we currently have. And by taking an open and honest look at the etiology of learning abilities and difficulties, we might be in a better position to do that, to educate more sensitively and to provide individual education plans for every child and focus on correcting for disadvantage as well as giving children extra advantages, I hope.
Well, what do you think about this, Ian Goldin, as an educator? Because this whole area of genetic advantage is a pretty controversial, sensitive issue, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it helps us understand why outcomes might be different. It hopefully will lead us to understand better how we need to calibrate and invest in inputs. So what more do you do to ensure that we create equal opportunity? And I think this is helpful in the sense it might help teachers and others, educators, understand why some kids just find something so difficult. It's not that they, you know, resistant. It's not that they're lazy. Mm-hmm. It's not anything else. They just do find it more difficult. And therefore, you have to invest more. You need better teachers. You need better investment in the system. And I think you need to really understand that unless you do that, you're not going to get fair outcomes.
Well, what do you think, Malcolm?
Well, I'm more interested about what this says about the attitudes of teachers and the design of curriculum, because it strikes me there's enormous implications here for improving the connection between the way we teach someone and the outcome we want. So if reading is a great example. As I understand it from what you were saying, we see these big differences, in part genetically driven, in facility and reading. But as a society, we're interested in facility, but we're really interested in something slightly different, which is we want you to like reading, and we want you to kind of think about what you read, right? Now, those overlap with facility, but there's a slight difference. So that the real interesting question is, by understanding what people's sort of baseline facility is, can we design curriculum that helps turn whatever that is into a love of reading, which is really, that's all we're interested in, right? I mean, my best friend who loves to read is an incredibly slow reader. So in his case, it's unusual. Something wonderful happened in his education or his home life to turn a difficult act, a naturally difficult act, into a pleasurable act. So to crack that puzzle would be fantastic. And I think this is kind of research that can help us do that.
I think that is very much what we would like to do. So when we say that it should be taken into account that children differ for genetic reasons as well as social reasons and all the factors, what that means to me is that we need to personalise children's learning environments. So if you've got a child who's maybe not so keen on reading but is really into fish, give them stuff to read about fish and really focus on their appetites as well as their aptitudes. And maybe that will help to draw out those skills that the child finds difficult. And I think we need to find a way of doing it. And that's how we will get more from more children, particularly the most vulnerable children.
It's also expensive. But that brings us on to political and economic choices. We'll talk about that a bit more in a moment. Hold on to your thoughts, all three of you. We'll be back with more discussion here on the forum straight after the news summary.
The BBC World Service.
If you're up in the sky...
Welcome to the latest global news. I'm Electra Naismith with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up...
Subterranean.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Today, a senior British police officer tells why she became determined to track down...
Or even submerged.
Hello, welcome to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond. Today, we're devoting the whole programme to the work of the service.
You can listen to your favourite BBC World Service programmes. Podcasting lets you automatically receive the latest episodes of your chosen programmes as soon as they're available, so you can listen whenever and wherever you want. Go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Still to come on the forum, the world seems to spin faster and faster. Our decision makers can hardly keep up. But if our children and grandchildren are not to be short-changed, we maybe should think less about our own advantage and focus on the future. New ideas for the long term from globalisation professor Ian Goldin, with input from psychologist Catherine Asprey and best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell. So stay with us. We'll all be back after the news summary.
BBC News with Nick Kelly. International talks in Geneva on Iran's controversial nuclear programme are continuing deep into the night. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has urged Western powers not to miss what he called an exceptional opportunity to reach an agreement. The French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, said Iran was resisting French demands that work on a plutonium-producing reactor be suspended. Many hundreds of people are thought to have died when the powerful typhoon Haiyan swept through the central Philippines on Friday. The Philippine Red Cross estimates that up to a thousand people could have been killed in just one city, Tacloban. There are reports that witnesses have seen 200 bodies in another province. Hundreds of bargain hunters in Venezuela have flocked to the Dhaka chain of shops a day after President Nicolas Maduro ordered a seizure of its goods. The Venezuelan president has promised to unload Dhaka's stock of plasma televisions, washing machines and other merchandise at fair prices. The Electoral Commission in the Maldives says, according to provisional results, the opposition leader and former president Mohamed Nasheed has secured the most votes in the presidential elections, but failed to win an outright majority. If confirmed, Mr. Nasheed would face a runoff with Abdullah Yameen, the half-brother of the former dictator Maumoon Abdul Gayoom. Spanish police have arrested the leader of one of Colombia's most violent drugs gangs. Ciprian Manuel Palencia González was detained in Madrid on accusations of committing murder, drug smuggling and extortion. It's thought González was in Madrid to set up new smuggling operations. And for the first time, an Olympic torch has been taken on a spacewalk. Ahead of the 2014 Winter Games in Sochi, two cosmonauts took the unlit torch out of the International Space Station. Olympic torches have been carried into space twice before, but the Sochi torch is the first to actually leave the spacecraft. BBC News.
This is the Forum from the BBC. Today we're looking at advantage, what it is that gives us the edge over others, and how can we ensure that we don't disadvantage future generations, our children and grandchildren. But now, time for our 60-second idea to change the world, and this week it's from psychologist Catherine Asprey. Catherine, you've got just 60 seconds to make your case to me, Bridget Kendall, and my other two guests, globalisation professor Ian Goldin and best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell. So if you've collected your thoughts, off you go.
Okay, so my 60-second idea to change the world is to invent a device that recognises when your brain is overloaded and quietly shuts down all your email and social media feeds. So I think it might work by sensing physical signs of stress and tiredness, so things like hormone levels and blood pressure, and when they cross a certain threshold, it could block off all new information and give you the time and space to process the things that are already cluttering up your brain. So there would be nothing we could do to stop it. It would be like a sick note from the doctor or a letter from your mum excusing you from gym class. I think a device like this is necessary because we don't have the willpower to do it for ourselves. I know I don't. We don't tend to switch off when it's all getting too much. And the more tired and stressed we are, the more likely we are to check email and Twitter and Facebook obsessively when we should be concentrating on more important things, like getting off the bus at the right stop or not walking into lampposts.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's a very cyberpunk idea, isn't it? Because it's the interface between your brain and the smartphone. And I suppose what I find quite spooky is that it's quite possible nowadays to imagine it. That not only would your screen say that your inbox was full because you'd run out of memory on your phone, but actually because you'd run out of juice in your brain.
Yes.
And so I suppose the question is, should we welcome it or not? What do you think, Malcolm?
I would love this idea, but my worry is the reason I check my email obsessively is that I worry that if I don't check it obsessively, then when I come back to it a day later, there'll be twice as many emails. So I get even more stressed out. So I worry what happens when you get fired up again and you know that, oh no, I have 500 emails instead of 100. Isn't that worse?
But ideally, you've had a good night's sleep. You've stopped worrying. You haven't been uploading all of these messages that actually you haven't got time to deal with. So you've just got the anxiety rather than the capacity to deal with them. So hopefully you would be more equipped to deal with them the next day. But I do know the horrors of a full inbox.
Ian Goldin, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful idea. The interesting thing is that when these breaks happen, because your computer goes down or because, as we've had in the UK in recent days, a storm stops people travelling to work or something, people really enjoy it. You get the sense of festivity often.
Time out.
And people find they can talk to their neighbours and they can think a little bit and have a little bit of time for other things. So I think we do value it. And I think this addiction to the short term, which is very much part of what I've been thinking about, is a great drug.
But you said something really interesting there, because it's about, like, you need to have a license from someone or something else in order to switch off. And so I was thinking that this is kind of like a message that says time to shut down and regenerate, as though, you know, it's a machine. You can't argue with a machine. If it runs out of power, that's it. And this is kind of telling you that it's time for your brain to have some rest. You've got to sleep so that your brain can sort through its contents. But you want this message from the outside, because you know that you can't do it yourself. So in that way, maybe this kind of interface with machines could be very helpful to us.
Yeah, I think it would be good, because I think it is addictive. And I feel quite sad sometimes when I get to the end of a train journey and think I've spent my entire time checking my email, looking at Twitter, looking at news. I used to read novels. I used to talk to my friends.
Look,
I used to think about the things that I'd read. And instead, it's information coming in all the time without me getting the opportunity to think about it. So, yeah, I think it would be a great thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Catherine Asprey. And if you're listening and you'd like to add your thoughts, don't forget that you can carry on the conversation via Twitter, Facebook, or email the programme directly. It means you can't switch off, of course, but we'd love to have your input. All details on our website. Just put in BBC and Forum into your search engine. Now, this is an idea about the future, and let's stay with the future and your perspective on advantage, Ian Golden, because as Professor of Globalisation and Development at Oxford University and Director of the Oxford Martin School, you focus very much on challenges to come, including how we could do better at thinking not just about our own personal advantage, but what would confer advantage on future generations.
Yes, I think in terms of advantage, this is certainly the best time in history to be alive, and it's certainly the best time to be born poor, because one's chances of escaping poverty are greater than ever in history, and our chance of living long, healthy lives are greater than ever in history. But our group of about 350 researchers in the Oxford Martin School is extremely worried. We believe that humanity is at the crossroads, that either we can see a century in which we overcome poverty, disease, and many of the things that afflicted us in previous generations, or it could be disastrous. We could see the worst century ever. We could even see the annihilation of much of humanity. And the choice is ours. It's partly as a result of our success. So more and more consumption, more and more energy use leads to climate change, more and more antibiotic use leads to antibiotic resistance, more and more financial intermediation leads to the potential for systemic financial crises. The tenure of governments is getting shorter. This is partly, again, a good story. More countries are becoming democratic, and there's many, many good parts to it.
I just want to bore down into that for a moment, because this conundrum that democratic governments may be a good thing because they give people more choice, but actually they encourage short-termism because the politicians have to think about how to get re-elected again in 4 or 5 years. That's one thing. But you're also making the point that there are other pressures that are making politicians think in a more short-term way. Can you just explain a bit more?
Well, it's partly the democracy, it's partly the instant media, it's walking out of a meeting room and having tons of people asking you what happened, lots and lots of civil society organizations, transparency, accountability, which is a wonderful thing, also means that you are constantly thinking about what you're going to say next, what's going to be in the papers, and how do you react to what's in the papers or on the blogs or wherever. And we do see, in terms of how long people are in power, there's only 3 leaders in Europe that are still in power since the financial crisis. So it really hurts to be taking big decisions and tough decisions and to suffer the consequences of failure. And we see in the US recently the absolute gridlock in politics, the inability to deal with the debt crisis, all turned up in short-term politics. The long issue, which is macroeconomic stability in the US and some very big decisions that have to be made on healthcare and many other areas, it's a hand grenade just being kicked down the road to be picked up in the future. So there's a lot of evidence around this. And of course, the question is, how do we break the gridlock? And the global institutions are unfit for purpose. I think there's an increasing gap between these issues which are boiling up, climate change, risk of pandemics, growing inequality, cyber vulnerabilities, youth unemployment. All of them transcend national borders because we're in a hyper-globalized world, and yet our governance is more and more national. So in this report, Now for the Long Term, which is the report of the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations, we try and think about how we would change this. And this is a group of 19 extremely experienced people with lots and lots of scars on their back, led by Pascal Lamy, who's been trying to lead a global trade negotiation since 2002 and has just stepped down as the Director General of the World Trade Organization, and many others. And we look towards a world where we would really invest in the long term by thinking about the next generation. So what is it we can do to protect the rights of young people, give them jobs, give them opportunity? How do we ensure that they're not in a worse off world because of climate change or because their antibiotics no longer work, because non-communicable diseases become so endemic? We cannot wait any longer for this ossified system to pick up the pieces. And it tends to only do that after terrible crises. We have to ensure that if we believe in the rights of ourselves and future generations to have a better world, and this incredible opportunity which we feel is there, if we can seize the moment of this, it's going to require much more action in an innovative way. And this is a really report which lays out a whole series of innovative recommendations.
Who would disagree with the general idea of that? The problem is, how do you get people who have power and take decisions to get away from the short term, to think beyond the selfish to the altruistic? A question for our psychologist, Catherine Asprey.
Well, obviously, I don't know the answer to such a huge question, but I think these are hugely important ideas that you're putting forward, Ian. And bringing it to education, which is my own area, I think education is a particular victim of short-term thinking. And I think a lot of the problem is that we are tied into this four-year election cycle. So a government comes into power, they want to make a mark, so they have to have an idea, not necessarily an evidence-based idea, just a hunch or something that's in line with their party political view. They then, within that four-year cycle, have to not only have and implement the idea, but prove that the idea worked and was beneficial to children. So no idea is properly researched in the first place. Even if they got lucky and their hunch was right, the idea doesn't have time to bed in, so it's thrown out because it hasn't shown signs of effectiveness. So I think we need to take education out of that party political structure, have a separate cross-party body that makes education policy and gives it the time it needs to be thought through properly, tested properly, and to stay the same. We need to let things stay the same.
That is part of one area of your recommendations, isn't it? Institutions which are somehow have independence from these political cycles.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And just to answer your question of how to make this real, the people who put their heads together for this report are not dreamers. I mean, these are all, you know, people with their feet firmly on the ground in business leadership positions, a couple of government ministers from China and India and elsewhere. And I think it's about incremental progress, but real ideas of institutional reform, including creating these agencies which are semi-autonomous. And there are lots of examples of those around the world, but they do tend to work accountable, but not buffeted by political winds all the time. That's one way of doing it. The other is to create institutions which are going to be perhaps focusing on a particular issue, but not necessarily at the national level. So we have a concept of fit cities, for example. Let cities move on certain things, as, for example, Mayor Bloomberg was trying to do in New York with banning big soda and some other things. And we've seen progress in this on smoking and in many, many other areas. We have the idea of a platform for exchange of information on tax to try and stop this dumping into the tax havens of all of our potential revenues that will feed our education systems and others. These are some practical incremental steps which are illustrative of the fact that we can move. We just have to take action.
What's your thoughts on this, Malcolm?
Well, I guess I would just say that the reason we lurch so far in the other direction is that long-term thinking got such a bad name during the era of the Soviet bloc and communism. And so we...
You mean a stagnation? Things,
yeah, we looked
change
at the five, you know, the kind of the joke about the 5 and the 10-year plans in the Soviet Union, that the central planners proved so terrible at long-term thinking that we went in the other direction. I agree with much of what you say, but the task is to be really clear about what specific things do we think are most appropriately dealt with in this way, and what things do we never want to make a prediction about and just trust the market? You know, I'm sure you guys have thought through this, but that's the case that has to be made to the public.
I would agree, and we certainly are not encouraging people to go back to sort of bad old planning, and the commissioners would, I think, have never joined the commission if that was the prospect. Although there is, interestingly enough, a senior Chinese minister who's in charge of the Chinese planning process as one of our 19 commissioners, and that, I think, has been an astounding success, what the Chinese have done in their planning process. Very different to the Soviet Union, but it's one of the key drivers of this highest growth rate the world has ever known over a longer period than the world's ever known. So planning isn't only bad.
But you can get seduced by the rational progression that you see from where we've got to. You know, some people are saying, well, in 10 years' time, how will we be looking at China? Maybe it'll be running into problems and we won't look at it in quite the same way. Just as Malcolm was saying, you know, when you really want to try and predict the really big things that are going to come, hard to do that. We'll certainly be wrong.
And this report is not about prediction. It's about preparing the institutional structures and society. We don't know what's going to happen next, but we do know that if we destroy the atmosphere and destroy the oceans and have youth unemployment, bad things will happen next.
But Ian, if you're critical now about global institutions and their ability to tackle some of these big problems, isn't there a danger that if you have new innovative institutions, but still with this broader stand-back perspective, that they'll just run into the same problems?
Yes,
the same global bureaucracy, the same inability to move forward because you've got to take everybody's view into
absolutely.
Account.
Absolutely, which is one of the key recommendations is the locking in of sunset clauses into all publicly funded global institutions.
People, sunset clauses means you've only got so long.
You've only got so long with guaranteed funding and support. After that, you have to account for yourself, you have to show that you're aligned to the issues, you have to show that you still are relevant, that you're adjusting if you're not. And we don't believe in giving these people some sort of guaranteed long-term life. We believe that all the existing global publicly funded institutions should be evaluated and judged according to their effectiveness, fixed or else disbanded.
I think we'd all agree the ideas are laudable. The question is, could this happen? There have been lots of reports, haven't there?
I've seen versions of this. And if you look at the things that the Gates Foundation, for example, has done, you're seeing a kind of prototype, aren't you, for what you're talking about? A well-funded, nimble, but very long-term oriented institution, which is profoundly international in outlook, has made an extraordinary difference in a very short time on a whole number of really central issues. So the idea is, can that model be replicated in different forms, not necessarily funded by a private fortune, but groups like that have done more to restore our faith in these kinds of interventions than almost anything else. So I think there is a reason for profound optimism here.
Yeah, I think the same thing. I think there's evidence around the world of good practice in this regard. I remember a few years ago going to Helsinki to learn about the Finnish education system, and that was very much what was emphasised there, that education is not a party political thing. It's taken separately. There is thinking about the future. There's long-term thinking that goes on, and the structures are in place to allow that to happen.
We should invite the Finns in, outsource all of our education to the Finns. But I'm only half joking, because I think that you could do that. You can walk around the world, and, you know, Canada apparently has a really good job with its accounting system, right? You know, you could sort of have the Canadians show you how to do accounting, the Finns show you how you do education, and now you're getting somewhere.
Maybe we should invite all our listeners to take up Malcolm's idea and propose to you what best practice they think their part of the world could offer.
We'd
to
be
this
delighted,
model.
And it's, our website has a platform for that.
Okay, well, thanks to all three of you, Malcolm Gladwell, Catherine Asprey, and Ian Goldin. And next week, we're off to Hong Kong to take part in the Arts Festival there, where I'll be joined by a panel and audience to probe the question, what gives island cities like Hong Kong their unique vibrancy? So be sure to join us. And until then, from me, Bridget Kendall, and all of us here at the Forum, have a good week. And for our usual bird song that we have to end the show, here's a soundscape of birds from Malcolm Gladwell's home country of Canada.